kill them.
Kill them both. We're missing the Antiques Roadshow.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 60. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I am looking at some not really big films, but interesting ones. They're not the largest ones, they're not the most well-known films, but they are with features of interest. How have you people been going? It's been, each time I do the podcast, it seems further apart, each podcast. And I'm getting this urge to do it fortnightly, but I've really got to kind of negotiate that with the domestic situation and a few other things there. So I still have an intention of going fortnightly with a podcast, but I've just kind of got to work that around. I can't do it next time because in 2 weeks' time, I'm flying up to Sydney to visit my sister and her boyfriend and their new child and my mother and doing the whole family thing for a weekend. And the weekend after that, I am podcasting again. Fortunately, I've got that one under control. So things here have been okay. The weather's warming up nicely. Work's going well. Been watching some films and things. And, not too bad. Before I get started, though, I'm going to let the people who aren't on Twitter and Facebook know that the next podcast after this one is going to be a special podcast where I look at the career of one actor. And this actor this time around will be Rod Taylor, the Australian-born expatriate actor we know from The Time Machine and Dark of the Sun and a whole bunch of other things. I've already got a comment about that podcast from Dr. Zom, which I'm saving till that podcast, but it seems to have got a good response from the people that I've tweeted at and Facebooked at. And so looking forward to doing that one. It's a good one to do because a lot of his stuff is accessible, but there are some obscure and very interesting films that Rod Taylor did. So I'm looking at that. Not that I expect him to drop off the twig anytime soon. He was born in 1930, which makes him 80 this year. But I'm not kind of doing a Death Watch kind of show. I'm looking at the guy's career and really grooving on it. And speaking of Death Watches, there were so many celebrities who died since the last time I podcasted. Just let me bring up my second favourite page in all the universe right after PornTube. Just be a moment and I'll get that up, which of course is the recent deaths page in Wikipedia. It's always a good way of tapping into who's croaked and who hasn't. So I'll just go backwards from the last few days. Roy Ward Baker, famous English film director, was never right at the top of the thing, but he did movies like The Vampire Lovers. He did Quatermass in the Pit. He did A Night to Remember, which was the English Titanic movie. He did Asylum and Vault of Horror in 73, and he did a shitload of episodic television for people like ITV back in the day. So Roy Ward Baker is the first one. Going backwards from there, let's have a look at this. A couple of days before that, I'm just doing that. Isn't this wonderful to listen to? Just me clicking my tongue while I look for things on the internet. Stephen J. Cannell, the American TV producer and writer, did The Rockford Files, The A-Team, 21 Jump Street, and some good stuff as well. Well, The Rockford Files being the good stuff. The other ones I could take or leave. So he croaked. And, of course, we'll go to the big one, Tony Curtis. Love Tony Curtis's work. Always found him to be an interesting character. His autobiography, if you can get a chance to pick it up, is definitely worth doing so. And the other person died, Greg Giraldo, the American comedian. I see him a lot on cable. Bit sad. He died of an overdose of prescription drugs, which is kind of like the Heath Ledger way of going. You forget that you're taking your prescription sleeping pills because the sleeping pills make you forget things. You take some more, and it is possible to overdose in that case accidentally, and in anybody's case, really rather tragically. So a lot of people stepping on rainbows recently, and always a sad thing. I do kind of watch the recent deaths thing on Wikipedia, and I think, geez, nobody really famous has died for a while. Have they invented an immortality drug or something? But no, that will happen for a little while, and then, unfortunately, people do start dying again. On that cheerful note, I'm going to move on. As I said, Rod Taylor next time around. Another Sydney boy made good, just like me. And an actor whose work, I think, is incredibly underrated. But I'll save all of the froth and the fury of that until next time around. So what have I been watching? I did pick up Iron Man 2 on Blu-ray. And we got it with a pack where you get a DVD copy and a digital copy as well as the Blu-ray. I know particularly that Sammy over at GGTMC is not really fond of this film, but I kind of like it. I'm a geek for superhero movies. I don't think it's as good as the first one. I think they were trying to pack too much in. It's a bit like some of the Spider-Man movies. You know, they try to pack way too much in to the running length to make it interesting, and that they tend to over-egg the pudding. But I still got a fondness for it. I still think Robert Downey Jr. does a nice nuanced performance. Gwyneth Paltrow's nice in it. Mickey Rourke, of course, is Mickey Rourke and does a great job. John Favreau gets to punch things out, and Scarlett Johansson doesn't have any facial expressions. And, of course, Don Cheadle taking up Terrence Howard's role as Rhodey does a pretty good job of it too, and I think he's a more engaging actor in some ways than Terrence Howard in this kind of a role. He knows what's required for the role and does a better job. And I did watch the first two of the Millennium Trilogy, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and The Girl Who Played with Fire. They tell me that the extended versions are much better, and I'm willing to believe them, and at some stage I will acquire copies of those and watch them. First one I got on Blu-ray, second one I got through illegal means because it's not yet available on Blu-ray. And yes, I like them very much. I perhaps prefer the original title of the first one, which was The Men Who Hate Women, because it is more to the core of the theme of the movie. And they're both very visceral, very dark movies with great protagonists. Of course, having been set in Sweden, they're a different world from the usual world we see in most of the cinema that we watch. And the acting is fantastic. The plots unwind in an interesting manner. Haven't read the books yet. I've got all three books. Sally bought them for herself. And, of course, I'll probably end up reading them before she does, because she's engaged in a couple of book series at the moment that are going to take up time for a while. But very much enjoyed the first two. The third one I've now acquired a copy of, which has decent subtitles. And one of the kind of post-podcast, chilling out with my feet up and some Pringles kind of things to do, is to watch that last one in the series. They tell me it's not as good as the first two, but I'm willing to suspend judgment until I see it myself. Anything else I've watched? I've been watching Fringe, which I always find interesting. I watch it as much and I've never done this with the TV series particularly, or at least consciously, But apart from the science fiction and the geek elements, I watch it for the acting. I very much watch it for John Noble's acting, to check the nuances of the acting that guy does. Fantastic actor. Did stage, as I said before on the podcast, in Adelaide for 20, 30 years before he really hit it with Fringe. And I always enjoy what he brings to the two roles he plays, Walter Bishop and, of course, Walton at the alternate universe version of Walter. Love that. So I've been watching Supernatural, and I've been watching a little bit of that, but I don't really get into it as much as she does. I've watched a few geeky things, nothing particularly memorable. I think when I mention the films that I've watched, what I might do, given the fact that I dip in and dip out of some movies, is only talk about the ones that I really enjoyed, which is a better segue than that previous one to talking about the three movies that are at the core of this podcast. First one is from I'm not going to do these in any particular order, by the way. First one is from 1962, The Cabinet of Caligari, which has very little to do with The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from the 1920s. It's a film directed by Roger Kay, starring Glynis Johns and Dan O'Herlihy. And I found it an interesting film. I found it an interesting film the first time I watched it late at night years ago. And as we all know, with Paleo Cinema, one of the things I tend to do lately is go back and revisit films that I saw on television back in the dim, dark past. This next one is an interesting one too. It's 1982's Wrong is Right, also known as The Man with the Deadly Lens. When it was first released in Australia in the cinemas, it was known as The Man with the Deadly Lens. It's a movie directed by Richard Brooks, and it stars Sean Connery, Robert Conrad, and Catherine Ross. And the interesting thing about this film in retrospect is that it is a movie that in some ways predicts the future, which, with leaving aside a few details, kind of parallels the Bush regime, the second Bush regime, post 9/11. But I'll talk about that one further when I get to it. And the third movie is actually a TV movie made in 1972, directed by David Green. It was done by ITV, who did a lot of the really classic, cool spy and action TV series in Britain in the 60s and 70s. It stars Robert Wagner and Betty Davis, and it's called Madam Sin, which is, it was quite a large budget movie for a television movie at the time, and it's a pretty cool little spy flick, which I really have a great fondness for. So they're the three movies. I'm going to take a break now, and then in a little bit, I'll get in and talk about, he said, thinking it through, probably Wrong is Right. I'll start with that, and then I'll get into the two other films after that. So back in a sec. Do 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 of course, was Julie London with Hot Toddy. You should have sung along if you knew the lyrics. But I just thought I'd throw that in there for a little bit of a cool break. And now on with the rest of the podcast.
It was a time when outer space was filled with incredible machines whose telescopic eyes and ears witnessed our most sensitive secrets. Information that could and did change the fate of nations. It was a time when no one on Earth could hide from technology. No people, no continent, no one was safe from spy satellites. It all could have happened in the recent past, or the present, or even in the near future. But it didn't. It did happen in that elusive time between now and later. That time when dark is light, when down is up, when foul is fair.
Wrong is Right, also known as The Man with the Deadly Lens, is a 1982 film based on a novel called The Better Angels by Charles McCarry, who was very much an insider in the Washington political scene. And it strays very much from the book, which I have a copy of and I read a number of years ago. It's set in a near future in which violence has become something of a national sport and television news has fallen to tabloid depths. Sean Connery plays Patrick Hale, a globetrotting reporter with access to a staggering array of world leaders. As the film opens, he has ventured to the Arab country of Maghreb to interview his old acquaintance, King Ibn Awad, played by Rod Moody. So they got a London Jew to play an Arab. Awad has learned that the President of the United States, George Grizzard, may have issued orders for his removal, and as a result, Awad is apparently making arrangements to deliver two suitcase nukes to a terrorist organization with the intention of detonating them in Israel and the United States unless the president resigns. I won't go any further than that. That's kind of like the start of things. Now, the president, played by Grizzard, is very much like George W. Bush. To a scary extent, in fact, and this film, you've got to remember, was made in 1982, and Bush only came in 2000. So there's definitely kind of like futuristic, future coming true kind of things, aspects to this. Now, I don't know whether any of this inspired World Trade Center bombings or anything like that. I wouldn't even venture to guess whether the people who perpetrated those particular atrocities had seen the film and gone, hey, that's a good idea. Don't know, probably would never be able to find out, but it's interesting the parallels. And also the Vice President of the United States, who does not bear too much of a resemblance, I'm phrasing that badly, she bears a bit of a resemblance to Condoleezza Rice, and played by Rosalind Cash, is the Vice President, and who makes a lot more sense than the President. So there are some things there. And also, the other aspect of the film that really kind of makes it prophetic in a lot of ways is the fact that the terrorist attacks, some terrorist attacks, are used as an excuse to go to war. So they very much had their finger on the pulse of real politics rather than the fake politics you'll see politicians themselves espousing. Now, the cast in this is particularly good. Now, I'm just going to go and get a cast list here to demonstrate what I say. I'll just name check a few of them just to give you a bit of an idea. You've got Sean Connery, of course. You've got George Grizzard playing President Lockwood. You've got Robert Conrad playing a character called General Wombat, who, you, based on the name, you've got to guess is a very broadly played satirical thing. You've got Catherine Ross, fine actress, playing a CIA spy. G.D. Spradlin playing the head of the CIA. You've got John Saxon playing Homer Hubbard, a CIA agent. And, of course, which is of most interest to a lot of the people listening to this podcast, Henry Silver playing Rafiq, the terrorist chief. Now, you've also got an ex-president, Mallory, played by Leslie Nielsen in a serious role. You've got to remember, this is around the time he started doing the comedy roles, but he still had a reputation as being a serious actor. You've got Robert Webber in there, fine actor. Hardy Kruger playing Hilbert Unger, an arms dealer. Dean Stockwell's in it, playing a guy called Hacker. It was a final theatrical film that Hardy Krueger did, and he had a long and distinguished career. I think I remember him most for Flight of the Phoenix, where he played an engineer in that film. And very, very cool actor who kind of almost dodged the stereotype playing Nazis that a lot of German actors had at the time. I think he kind of was a bit more nuanced than a lot of them and didn't necessarily fall into that trap. Variety called the movie Richard Brooks's shriek of protest at what he sees as the insane downward spiral of world history over the past decade. Since being made, and particularly in this decade, the film's definitely got an enhanced reputation. James Plather of A DVD Town said of the film, "It's impossible to watch it more than 20 years later without seeing a ton of eerie similarities to the Bush White House." And Paul McGilligott at Civil Hero said, "The idea of the US going to war in the Middle East over dubious claims of terrorists possessing weapons of mass destruction, specifically atomic bombs, is central to the plot. The discovery of the aforementioned bombs dangling from an antenna on the top of the World Trade Center is probably far more chilling now than the filmmakers could ever have intended." So it's really weird how certain films, and tell me if you can recall any other ones, certain films that predict a future, aspects of which come true. It's an interesting area of cinema to dive into. It's weird how, I suppose, with so many futures being posited by so many films, occasionally a film has to kind of get it more or less right, particularly with something as world-changing as 9/11. Having a film paralleling that, based, you know, being filmed in the 1980s, is an interesting phenomenon, and it can only happen in Hollywood, I suppose. But I do like this film for another number of reasons. One of which hasn't been mentioned very much is the fact that Sean Connery here plays a journalist, and Sean Connery is notorious for having an intense hatred of journalists. He really can't stand that breed of human being, and his disdain for them, I suppose, feeds into his playing of the role. He plays Hale like a guy kind of cruising through things and not, you know, doing the compassion thing on screen, but on when he's doing the news reports, but not necessarily caring much about it. He's more interested in the quality of the story rather than getting into the depths of it. The quality, by which I mean, you know, finding out the truth, but not necessarily using it in any meaningful way. The film's a broad satire in a way, but it doesn't really, the punchiest of satires, particularly political satires, tend to be cohesive. They've got a constant stream. They're not one thing or the other. But this one kind of has moments of slapstick mixed in with some very kind of gritty and tense action scenes. And I'm not sure whether the two blend particularly well. The film plays some of the action scenes, particularly one involving a booby-trapped light bulb, very seriously. And a couple of other things. There's a scene where one character is being chased by one of the terrorist group and a bomb is planted. And that scene is beautifully laid out. I mean, the tension's there. Everything's in place. It runs really, really well. But I'm not sure how much it kind of marries well with the more broader comedy of some of the other scenes. It's a hard thing, I suppose, to balance those things. You're basically doing a satire using a very intensely serious world problem as the core of it. And I'm not saying don't do it by any means. Of course, filmmakers should be transgressing any of those kind of limitations that other people might impose on them. But in this case, the broad satire maybe should have been done differently. And now, I'm not going to say that it's a bad film. I think it's an interesting film. I don't think it's a great film, but it's interesting more in retrospect than it would have been at the time. And at the time, there weren't all that many people treating the threat of Islamic terrorism very seriously. Now, I'm just going to play another clip from the film now, and kind of wrap up for it and move on to the next one. But Wrong is Right is definitely a film that if you haven't seen it, please do. You'll find some bits of it uncomfortable in retrospect, given subsequent history. But there's enough engaging actors in there. There's interesting bits and pieces. And there's also an underlying theme of media responsibility, how media and politicians and the military can be in each other's pockets very much, and how that's not necessarily a positive thing for the general well-being of society or even the whole planet. So there's an underlying theme there. It's not particularly outstandingly prominent, but the theme is definitely a part of the film.
Mr. Hale, we only try to do what's right.
Even when it's wrong.
If it's good for America, it can't be wrong. Right?
What's next?
War!
These atom bombs on our land constitute an act of war. Undeclared war. Unprovoked war. Started by the bloodiest terrorist of modern history.
Okay, I'm just going to take a break now and then move on to the second of the three films. And I think I will make it The Cabinet of Caligari. Back soon.
Gossip Calypso, Gossip Calypso, hear all about it, yak a yak yak. Every woman up at the window, giving out the gossip and getting it back. Oh, Mrs. Brown, well, how are you now? I tell you, I've had a shocking time with an any stomach. Don't talk to me, my Charlie has gone and fallen down the stairs again. Saints preserve us, poor old chap, did he hurt himself? Well, not as much as Alf, that's my cousin Fred's boy. I learned from Fred, the doctor said, he'll have to have his kneecap scraped. Oh, blimey, singing gossip, Calypso, gossip, Calypso, hear all about it, yak a yak yak. Every woman up at the window, giving out the gossip and getting it back. Oh, Mrs. Booze, have you heard the news? That woman, you know, the very fat one down at the corner, climbed in a truck, got stuck. They think that they're never gonna get her out. Do tell me, well, I had a fella round and gave him a pound to free her with an oxyacetylene welder. Must send along some books. It looks like she's gonna be there quite some time. Oh, blimey, singing gossip, Calypso, gossip, Calypso, hear all about it, yak a yak yak. Every woman up at the window, giving out the gossip and getting it back. Oh, Mrs. Ware, I do like your hair. Who does it? I go to Madame Pom Pom round by the gasworks with all that fruit. It looks so cute. I can't believe it's really you. Like a film star, have you heard, dear? A little bird has told me Mrs. Tate's expecting her seventh. Well, glory be, that's three she's had since Lenny had his tonsils out. Cold blimey, singing gossip, Calypso, gossip, Calypso, hear all about it, yak a yak yak. Every woman up at the window, giving out the gossip and getting it back, giving out the gossip and getting it back.
That was Bernard Cribbins with Gossip Calypso. Moving on to The Cabinet of Caligari, 1962.
How old were you when you first let a man make love to you? Next, who was he? Next, how did you feel at the time? Next, how did you feel afterward? What did you feel? What did you think? Were you pleased, frightened, ecstatic, disgusted? What did he say? What words did you speak? That's what I want to know. Now, tell me. Now, now, all of it.
What are you thinking now? Tell me now. What are you feeling? Tell me now, now. Look at me. What does it feel like not to have any feeling? Go ahead. Look at me. I wish the whole house were here, all of them, not to see me, to see you.
Right up front, I'll tell you two things about this film. The first is there is an unreliable narrator in it. The viewpoint character, the young lady, Jane Lindstrom, played by Glynis Johns, is unreliable. So everything you see is seen through her eyes, which makes it an interesting film. The other thing I will tell you about the film is this. There is a lovely twist at the end of it. And the film should be seen twice just so that after knowing what the twist is, you can go back and reevaluate what occurs during the film in light of that revelation at the end of it. It really does bear watching with that in mind. Now, it's a twist that's been used more recently in a film by a very famous film director. I won't do a spoiler, because if I tell you what the film is and you've seen that film, you'll get an idea what the twist is in this film, but I won't do that. But I'll just do a bit of a plot synopsis and then talk about why this film is quite interesting. Motorist Jane Lindstrom has a blowout and seeks assistance at an estate that she learns is owned by a very polite man named Caligari. After spending the night, she finds that Caligari will not let her leave and proceeds to ask some very personal questions of her and shows her disgusting pictures. Unable to leave due to guards and unable to call out due to lockdown phones, Jane tries to find allies among the other guests but only finds three possible candidates: an older man called Paul, a younger man called Mark, and a lovely elderly woman named Ruth, played by Estelle Winwood. After seeing Ruth tortured, Jane goes to Paul, who convinces her to confront Caligari. But I won't go any further than that. It's one of those films where kind of psychoanalysis is it's very much central to the plot of things. Now, it was written by Robert Bloch, the author of Psycho, and who also wrote a number of horror stories. Robert Bloch, great reputation. Really interesting guy. He did some other films that I kind of like very much. I'll just do a little bit of a list of them. He wrote things like, he did Psycho, of course, Caligari, The Night Walker, a 1964 film, which is quite interesting, with Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor in it. The Skull from 1965, which had Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. A movie from 1966, which is fantastic. I want to get a copy of this, The Psychopath. He did Torture Garden in 1967, The Deadly Bees, The House That Dripped Blood, Asylum, The Dead Don't Die, a TV movie from 1974 that I've got to pick up a copy of as well. And he also did a couple of episodes of Star Trek, I believe. Give me a moment to just double check that. I think it may have been one or two episodes of Star Trek. Let me see what I've got here. Don't have the details, but I know he did at least one episode. So, interesting guy, interesting writer, very much in the kind of horror and genre areas of things. Now, this film, beautiful black and white photography, lovely, sharp copies of it are available. It's not one of these films that I'm going to talk about where you can only get really bad VHS copies of. It is available on DVD from Amazon and all the other usual places. I don't know whether it's on Netflix, but I suspect it would be for those in the States and Canada. The actors in this are interesting. Gwyneth Johns, I liked for ages. I talked about a couple of her films back a number of podcasts ago, Miranda and Mad About Men. This is her slightly older, in the 1960s. Those films were in the late 40s and early 50s. But she's still an attractive woman, and she's got that kind of slightly croaky, smoky kind of voice, which I kind of like. So Gwyneth Johns, a bit of a hottie. Dan O'Hurley, great character actor. He did the Bunuel Robinson Crusoe in about, I think it was 1954, and he got an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor. I'm going to have to revisit that film again too. I did see it very, very long ago. So many films, so little time, and so much good stuff out there to watch. There are times when I get a bit disgusted with myself for watching too much trash, when I know that there are good films out there that I enjoy, but I'm kind of it's like being a junk food junkie at times. I really should watch more better films than I do, but Bunuel's Robinson Crusoe is one I should definitely track down to watch and enjoy again. Even when I did see it when I was in my, I would have been a teenager, maybe early 20s, something like that. I recall it fascinating me then, so definitely going to have to revisit that one. I really should take notes on these things and make a list. And by the way, while I'm on the subject, I'm digressing a bit here, so bear with me. Thank you to everybody who gives me movie recommendations through Facebook and Twitter and other places. I'm not necessarily going to name check you guys now because I get so many of them, but I do appreciate them, and they are going into my Watchmen notebook, and I will get to them eventually. It's just one of those things where I only have a limited amount of hours. But back to the film itself. Now, Ahuahi actually plays a double role in this film as both Paul and as Caligari, and they are subtly different characters. Caligari is very kind of dark and saturnine, and Paul's very much a more sympathetic character. But he does a good job of it. He's got a beautiful kind of resonant voice. He brings to the film a menace without overdoing the menace, because were he to be a really over-the-top, theatrically menacing character, the twists and the unreliability of the narrator really wouldn't work very well. So it's nicely modulated to what's required by the ultimate twists of the plot. There are some other actors in it. There's still a woman playing a feisty old lady. She's great. I remember her mostly for playing an old lady seducing and seduced by Zira Mostel in The Producers. Good actress. Constance Ford's in this. She was also in 1944 100% Dead playing a brothel keeper. She's a much more sympathetic character in this film. And also Lawrence Dobkin, who people might remind, a bald character actor, did any number of films in the 50s and 60s, but his face is one that you'll definitely recognise. Now, this film does the kind of psychiatrist as mad scientist almost trope. There are any number of films in the 50s and 60s that kind of show people's fear of being psychoanalysed and fear of people diving into their minds and questioning the motives of people who did that. There's films like The Cobweb in the mid-1950s and this one and a number of other kind of psychological and psychoanalytical threat films where people find psychiatrists and that whole process of healing mental illness in a threatening way. I suppose Shock Corridor, in a sense, is a somewhat of a film in the same vein, where basically the insane asylum kind of films, where people's loss of self and loss of control is exacerbated by the manipulations of people who have a training in psychology and psychiatry. So, some people felt threatened by that, and some people indeed still do. A lot of people find it very useful, but there's still that kind of trope of people in the mental healing arts, in a sense, having that great potential, which unfortunately does occur, to do more harm than good and to take advantage of their privileged situation as a kind of confident healer. So this film definitely taps into that. It's interesting. One of the things to notice when you're watching this film is the dialogue. Now, the dialogue sounds stilted and kind of cliched and silly at times, but you've got to listen to it a little bit carefully when you do. And again, that twist towards the end does put a lot of the dialogue in the film into perspective. The way Caligari and the other people around Jane Lindstrom act, and the way she herself reacts to various situations and even subtle things, is very much kind of sourced from that twist at the end of the film. Now, I'm being deliberately vague here because I really don't want to give it away. If you haven't checked it out, do. It's an interesting film from that kind of mid-1960s, small second feature kind of thing. It wasn't an enormous budget film. It was 99% shot in a studio, and it has that kind of studio-bound look about it. But that kind of works in a sense because of the kind of story it is. The unreliable narrator, the twist at the ending that puts the whole lot into perspective. Having it on a studio set works with that rather than against it. And I think one of the problems that a lot of people who come to old movies from, you know, anyone, say, 20, 30, who comes into old movies, having studio sets is an unfamiliar thing to them. There's so much location shooting and realistic sets in modern film that people who aren't brought up watching old films really do seem to have a little bit of a disconnect in accepting a studio set as a kind of reality. But in this film, it works in context. And this is one of my favourite twists at the end of a film. It's not a big one. It's not like, you know, Rosebud is a sled or Kaiser Soze is Verbal Klimt or anything like that. But it makes sense within the world of the story. Now, as far as psychiatrically, whether in the real world of psychiatry and psychiatric stuff, whether the plot of the film has any validity as a kind of healing method is to be questioned, but you just got to go along with the ride to it. It's that thing again in films where you've got to accept one silly thing sometimes to make the whole film work. And as long as there's not more than one, possibly two absurdities in a film, audiences will go along with it. Their goodwill will carry them through into an acceptance of that film. So I won't play any other clips from the film apart from that little sting I did at the front. It's very much an interesting film. It's very much a film that's got a unique twist to it. You can't say this film is like that film with this one particularly. It's a standalone, which is always an interesting place for a film to be. It wasn't so successful that it spawned imitators at all. And I think it was mostly done on the basis of Bloch's enormous success with Psycho. It might not have been made otherwise, but it's an interesting film. It would have been great to see it at drive-in with some other films as well. It's got that, doesn't go over long. I'll see if I can find out the length of the film here. 105 minutes, so it's not too long. The only real downside I found to it is I found the music by Gerald Fried a little bit overdone, but and slightly repetitive. But one of the problems with these films where the budget isn't as enormous, and even though this was made by Fox, they didn't really invest a lot of money in this, that the music that they can afford to do for a film, the music by a guy called Gerald Fried, the music they can afford to do, they can't necessarily get the orchestras in to do immense long, you know, they basically can't orchestrate the whole film. So there are a number of themes that come in and the themes are repeated, and that maybe is the reason for that repetition. But see it. It's from 1962, The Cabinet of Caligari, starring Glynis Johns, Dan O'Hurley, Lawrence Dobkin, Estelle Winwood and Constance Ford. If you haven't seen it, you might be pleasantly surprised. It's not fantastically mind-shattering, but it's an interesting film with an interesting twist to it. Back soon with the third film. And to be honest with you, some ways my favourite of the three films, Madam Sin.
Two dedicated nuns on charitable work for their mother superior.
Do you spare something for the orphan children of Saint Cecilia?
Today they've collected a top American agent.
Where am I?
The island.
What island?
There is only one island.
held prisoner by the president of international crime and espionage, the mysterious...
Madam Sin.
A bigger threat to mankind than World War III.
Madam Sin's engaged in every major enterprise that's worth being engaged in.
That's Mr. Willoughby. I'm very fond of him.
He invented that little weapon that gave you such an awful headache.
I want you to help me hijack a Polaris submarine.
Just one?
Well, one is all my customer wants. He only has $1 billion to spend.
Trapped, confused, alone in a living nightmare of terrifying dimension and alarming reality.
You know who that is?
I used to work with him, Petty Cavendish.
I suppose you want me to kidnap the man.
Yes, it's quite a sophisticated box of tricks they've got down there. It gets right into the memory cells of the brain and places any information that Madam Sin wishes to be placed there.
You are really something. You're not a woman. You're a disease. You should be wiped out. You're poisonous.
Betty Davis is Madam Sin. Robert Wagner. Denham Elliott. Gordon Jackson. Dudley Sutton. Catherine Shell.
I'll explain everything when you get me away from here. But not now. She'll kill me for real. She'll kill us both.
There's no escaping Madam Sin. In a deadly duel of man against machine, the hunter becomes the hunted. Madam Sin, a compelling woman and a compelling mystery of double-dealing action and adventure beyond the frontiers of science. Watch out for Madam Sin. She could be the death of you.
I love that trailer. It's so 1970s. It's so much a part of its time in some ways. Now, I'll just do a bit of a plot summary. The trailer does a good job of it, but I'll just enhance it a little bit. Madam Sin is a vicious villainess who commands a thought factory in the Scottish Highlands. Intent of achieving world domination, she kidnaps ex-CIA agent Anthony Lawrence, played by Robert Wagner, and forces him to help her hijack a secret nuclear weapon, the Polaris submarine. Which is not a secret nuclear weapon, it's a delivery system for nuclear weapons. But anyway, that's pretty much it. It's got Betty Davis as Madam Sin, Robert Wagner starring as Anthony Lawrence, Denholm Elliott as Malcolm Devere, her henchman, Gordon Jackson as Commander Cavendish, Dudley Sutton, who's a character actor you might know, and if you don't, look him up on YouTube. He's actually got some YouTube videos up of him reciting humorous poems, which is really good fun. Catherine Schell's in it as Barbara. You might remember her from the second season of Space 1999, where she played the shape-shifting alien chick. And that's pretty much it. The film was a pilot for a proposed TV series for ABC, and it didn't make the schedule, which is a shame because I kind of like it. It's very groovy. It was broadcast in the States in January 1972, then released in foreign markets as a feature film. And for a TV pilot, it had a very, very high budget. There's some great scenes in the Scottish Highlands. There's some helicopter shots. It's very much more interesting than the James Bond films of the time, in my book. The Roger Moore James Bond films weren't anywhere as interesting as Madam Sin. Now, Robert Wagner at the time was spending a lot of time in Europe. He'd just come off making It Takes a Thief, his fantastic TV series in the late 60s, where he played Alexander Mundy, the jewel thief. Betty Davis's career was in decline. It had been since the studio system ended in the 1950s. She did a few kind of things like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and films like that. And from all reports, she loved doing this role because it was just so over-the-top silly. Basically, she was playing Fu Manchu as a woman. So there's that kind of, you know, Madam Sin looks slightly oriental with the makeup and the hairstyle and the general atmosphere around her. So basically, this is Fu Manchu as a woman, and as a very powerful and ruthless woman. She kidnaps scientists and brainwashes them and gets them to make groovy inventions for her. One of the inventions is a sonic weapon, which is a handheld sonic weapon, which is used to really good effect. In the film, she has a machine that'll basically brainwash people very effectively. She's got three-dimensional lifelike holograms, and in general, just all those kind of groovy 1960s, 1970s spy film, super science kind of things. And in some ways, of course, this film is science fiction. You've got a brainwashing machine, you've got some handheld sonic weapons, which are incredibly powerful, and you've got a kind of woman who wants to take over the world, and the way she wants to do it more than anything, and this of course taps into the Austin Powers thing, where Robert Wagner was a part of the Austin Powers thing, is the fact that she very much is an economic power as much as a terrorist. She runs a number of legitimate enterprises from her castle in the Scottish Island off the coast of Scotland. And this film's a lot of fun. I mean, you know, Robert Wagner playing his suave, debonair, secret agent kind of persona is quite good in this. And he does a bit of a variation on it too. Anthony Lawrence is very much on the outer. He's a retired spy. He doesn't have too many prospects. And even though he has had a career in there, there's an implication that maybe he's hit the booze a little bit. And become unreliable because of that. And while walking through a park one day, a couple of nuns come up to him to ask for a donation for a charity, and then zap him with a sonic weapon. Sonic weapon's interesting too. It doesn't just knock you out, it kind of stuns you for a prolonged period of time, and makes it easy for you to then be grabbed and kidnapped. And that's, of course, all a part of Madden Sin's nefarious plot to get a Polaris submarine and sell it for $1 billion to some rather shady people. That is implied that they may be from somewhere like perhaps Cuba. And and even though the trope of the kind of evil oriental mastermind goes back to the early part of the 20th century, this is a nice little iteration. They do a nice job of updating it to 1970s technologies, and It's not to be taken seriously, even though it does have a kind of a grim ending to it in some ways. It's a bit of a fun romp, and even when it's serious, it's not taking itself too seriously. And visually, the film is very interesting. The choice of sets and the choice of locations makes it somewhat different from the usual spy tropes. A lot of spy movies are kind of urban, if you know what I mean. They're set in large cities for the most part. They're very much centered around population centers. This one isn't. Apart from the initial scenes in London, it pretty much mostly takes place either... There's some bit that's sort of in Spain. There's a bit seen towards the end that's in Spain. But for the most part, they're in the offshore islands off Scotland, in a couple of coastal towns in Scotland, and on a Polaris submarine, of course. But the film takes the spy tropes away from that that city environment and does quite a good job with it. I mean, the locations are slightly reminiscent of one of the films that's contemporary to this one, pretty much, which is The Wicker Man. There are some nice aerial shots from a helicopter scooting over the offshore islands in Scotland that reminded me a little bit of that. And I like Robert Wagner as an actor. I mean, there are any number of his films that I find interesting because he's in them. I don't think he was ever an incredibly complicated actor. I think he was very much in that star mold, having come out of the studio system in the 1950s, and he was never going to be, you know, top acting chops kind of roles, but he does a competent job, and he's got that incredible likability, which helps him put across that kind of even in the most absurd of situations. And I think as a television actor of his own, rather than as a film actor. I think once he got past the young pretty boy stage, his talents lended themselves better to television than to film. That isn't to dismiss a lot of the good work he did in a number of films. But Bette Davis, too, is having fun in this one. And that was one of the kind of sad things about films of the past. When a woman, an actress, reach a certain age, they stopped letting them have fun in roles, unless they were going to be totally absurd and laughed at rather than laughed with. But this one, with her playing the evil dragon lady kind of role, she has some fantastic dialogue to play with and does seem to be incredibly amused by the absurdity and the overtopness of it. And it's fun watching her do that. Denholm Elliott's in there as well, playing the usual smarmy sidekick, upper-class English guy. And he gets a lot of dialogue. I mean, the dialogue is quite cool. There's some bits of it that basically play along with the conceits of the film in a nice way. It would have been nice to see the TV series as well. You know, Bette Davis playing a dragon lady in a spy series in the 1970s with various guest stars coming in and trying to foil her nefarious plots. Yeah, I could see that. That'd be a fun TV series. I would have liked to have seen a season or two of that. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Maybe the expense of the original pilot put the studio off, or just maybe they were stupidly relying on the kind of crap 1970s TV that we got in a lot of cases to see them through. But Madam Sin's worth a bit of fun. It's 75 minutes long, so it's not particularly going to take up a large chunk of your lifespan. But I think the action scenes as well are quite effective. There's a scene where Dudley Sutton in a helicopter is chasing around Robert Wagner with a sonic weapon. And the kind of, you know, even though it had been done previously, of course, in From Russia with Love, that kind of, you know, protagonist being chased by a helicopter, if it's done well, it can, you know, it doesn't have to be a cliche. I mean, it was done probably most recently really well in Broken Arrow, the John Woo film from a decade or so ago, and a couple of other things, of course, in the most recent Die Hard, where they took out a helicopter with a car. But I think the helicopter chase thing, if cut together well and if filmed well, it doesn't have to be a cliche. And this film does show that. So that's about it. Madam Sin, check it out. Nice, fun flick. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and then we'll get on to the feedback.
Plays with men just like a cat plays with mice. Sometimes a smooth operator comes along, but she soon changes his song. But try and catch her, you'll find this bird will bite. Eyes shining bright and a smile that lights the sky is just the perfect disguise. The girl
That was the theme song to The Girl from Rio, a Jess Franco-directed Eurospy movie from the late 1960s. It's kind of got that bossa nova thing happening there. And the Italian film composers at that time, there's always a kind of, you can identify them just by the orchestrations, and that's very much part of that. So I kind of enjoy it. Now it's time for the voicemails. The first one I've got is from Rupert. It's a bit short, but sweet. So I'll just play that for you right now.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert one more time. I was just remembering, my wife and I were watching part of Ralph Bakshi's movie Wizards last night. I just got the UK Blu-ray of it from Eureka, and I believe it's region free, so it should be okay to play on anybody's PlayStation or Blu-ray player. I think you should be good, and it looks great. And I know you've talked about Bakshi on the show. I just wondered if you're a fan of Wizards, and if you could reiterate which Bakshi you're most a fan of, and if you've covered some on the show, because I feel like you might have, but I can't remember. Anyway, that's all. Okay, bye.
Thanks for that, Rupert. I may have name-checked Bakshi once or twice on the show. I was just looking through his filmography again to get familiar with it. I do like Fritz the Cat. Of course, his first feature film after he kind of left doing animation for TV and things like that. But let's see, Heavy Traffic I haven't seen in a long time. Coonskin I haven't seen. Wizards, I really haven't seen since it first came out, and I've really got to kind of revisit that. His Lord of the Rings, I remember at the time around 78, I was talking a few years after that with some people who were really enormous Tolkien fans, and they had some disparaging things to say about that, but they tended to do that about anything that that was more or less popular. Fire and Ice, I'm not sure I've seen that. Cool World turns up every now and then on cable here. It's kind of that combination of live action and animation he did with Kim Basinger and Brad Pitt in 1992. And that one's a kind of like a sexier Roger Rabbit kind of deal there. I really, if I was going to do a Bakshi, what I'd probably do is Fritz the Cat. I kind of like that. I like that underground comic book kind of vibe. And at the time I first saw that, I was occasionally finding copies of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers and other comics like that. And because it was, of course, a cartoon which had cartoon nudity in it, it was something of a rarity at the time. But so if I was going to pick a couple of Bakshi to talk about on the podcast, Fritz the Cat would be one of them, and as you, the one you name checked, them Wizards would probably be the other to kind of look at. I'll put it on the list. I'm sure I can get copies of them. I'm not sure as to whether I'm going to go the Blu-ray. I'm kind of being selective about my purchases at the moment a little bit, even though the exchange rates are getting quite good. The Australian dollar is almost at parity with the US dollar, which makes accessing a lot of this stuff a lot easier than it has been in the past, when we were running around 70 or 80 cents to the US dollar. We're now up around 98. But thanks for that one, Rupert. And by the way, I'm going to do a public congratulations on this. Congratulations on the Dick Miller interview you're doing over at GGTMC. Dick Miller, of course, is a cult movie god. And I always like the fact that you've got access to these people, and the questions you ask are always cogent and interesting when you do. So good on you for that, mate. Okay, on to the next one.
Hey, this is Richard in Wichita. Just calling in with some random comments and a few questions throw your way. First off, as always, I'm enjoying the podcast, loving your review of movies that are definitely out of the mainstream. You know, I love to hear about movies that are mainstream, but I also really enjoy hearing about these films that I, you know, would probably never hear about in any other podcast. And oftentimes these films just are not that easily available, and I always kind of view that as a fun challenge, and it's always cool when you get that movie in your hands that you've just discovered, and you had to kind of go through all sorts of obstacles and hoops and such to go ahead and get it in your grubby little hand. So that's just one of the main reasons I really love your show. With that said, no worries on having not watched Unman Wittering in Zygo. I do look forward to your comments on that film and what you think about it once you do get a chance to see it. Let's see. The Tenth Planet. That is number one on my Netflix, or The Tenth Planet. The Tenth Victim. How about that for a title? The Tenth Victim. It's number one on my Netflix queue, again, based on your recommendation. So it should be arriving really any day now. And hopefully I'll get a chance to watch that sometime in the next week. I really look forward to that. Let's see, Shock Corridor. I'm not sure that I told you this or not, but I did get a copy of Shock Corridor. They actually aired it on Turner Classic Movies. And I did get a chance to watch that, and I really enjoyed it. Now, I know you said you weren't a big Peter Brecht fan as far as The Big Valley goes. Well, you know, that's no big deal there. It is a cheesy 1960s Western. I have a special love for it because, you know, I saw like every episode 10 million times when I was a kid. You kind of do those things when you only have three channels as an option. But I loved seeing Peter Brecht in an earlier role and in a different role. He doesn't have a large body of work, so it's always fun to see an actor who, is kind of playing somebody totally different than what you're used to seeing him on, especially if they're like in a television series where you obviously see them playing the same character, you know, over and over again. So that was a really cool, great recommendation, and had a lot of fun watching that. And let's see, I've got a couple of questions for you. I'm kind of curious on a few films, if you've had a chance to see any of these films. I'm just going to kind of throw three of these titles at you. One of them is called Quintet. I don't have the date right in front of me. I think it's 1979. It's kind of an odd sci-fi futuristic film with Paul Newman. We recently got satellite again, and that means we got the Fox Movie Channel. Now, Fox Movie Channel seems to be very repetitive. They don't have as good a selection of films as I remember them from a few years ago, and they're kind of on my list because they have somehow blocked the ability to record a movie. I can do it on DVR, but when I try to burn it onto a DVD, it's got some type of copy guard on it, which is really kind of irritating. But I'm kind of curious what you think about this movie. It's got kind of an odd visual look to it. It's almost like it's kind of fuzzy around the edges, but I know that's kind of intentional with the film. It takes place in like the futuristic winter wonderland. I've got this movie DVR'd. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet other than just a few clips, and it really kind of intrigued me. So I'm looking forward to know if you've seen that movie or not. A movie called The Witchmaker, 1969, is another kind of quirky film that I picked up. And the only reason I picked this up is because I saw it listed as being one of eight movies that were being shown at a Pennsylvania drive-in movie marathon. I think it's DVDDriveIn.com were like the main sponsors of this. And The Witchmaker was one of the movies they were airing on a Friday night. I'd never heard of it before. And managed to find a copy of it on eBay. And it's actually a pretty good film. It's got some character actors that I recognize some other things. It's got a very attractive German actress by the name of Thordis Brandt, who plays the character of Anastasia. It's basically about a psychic and his assistants. They investigate a series of murders, and there's all sorts of gorgeous late 1960s women in it. It's a very odd little film, but I kind of was drawn to it. I kind of enjoyed it. So I wonder if you've seen that. And last but not least, the third film I want to know if you've ever seen, and that's Inchon. I am trying to find specifically two films right now. Based on your recommendation, Nothing Lasts Forever, which looks like that's going to be a very hard film to find. But I'm also in search of Inchon. This is the 1982 film that has been blasted as one of the worst movies ever made. It starred, I believe, Peter O'Toole, if I'm correct. And I could be wrong about that. But the biggest thing about this movie, and I'm sure you know the history about it, is that it was financed by the Mormon Unification Church, which made it controversial, and it bombed in the theaters. It was pulled out of release very quickly. It did air, I believe, and I've read different things on this, I think that it may have aired on HBO in the early 80s very briefly, like I'm talking one or two airings before they yanked it. The only other time this film has ever surfaced was in 2001 on a kind of a low-budget cable network called American Life Network. It's gone by a variety of different names, Good Life Television, Nostalgia Television. From 2001 to 2009, this particular network was owned by the Unification Church, and one of the first things they did was to air this movie. Now, Inchon has never been released on DVD, VHS, and is not an easy movie to find. And from what I've been able to understand, if you find a copy of it now, most likely it is off of its 2001 television airing. So wonder if you've ever had a chance to see that. This film is, I want it simply because it's rare. It may be a horrible movie, but my curiosity is killing me. So with that, I know that's a lot of questions and random comments, but I hadn't called in a while, so I just wanted to leave you a voicemail, let you know that I'm loving the show as always, and take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for that, Richard. I've made a note. I've actually got Quintet downloaded and The Witchmaker downloaded, so thank you for those recommendations. I'm going to have to start a special Richard folder somewhere on my storage. So I've got those to watch. I think I've seen a bit of Quintet or maybe the trailer for it somewhere, but I'm going to watch it at some stage. As I said, so many films, so little time. But Inchon, I've just done a quick search for us, and no, the damn thing doesn't seem to be anywhere. There was a torrent of it about a year ago, but there are no CDs on it, so can't download it that way. I think Laurence Olivier was in there. Give me a moment to just check out the database, and I'll give everyone a little bit of an idea about who and what was in Inchon. Just be a few moments. Wow, don't you love the internet? It made less than $2 million in the box office, according to IMDb. It's directed by Terrence Young, who I believe directed a little bit of our mate James Bond's films. From Russia with Love was directed by him. So, Inchon, let me see. Laurence Olivier was in it. Good cast. Olivier, Jacqueline Bisset, Ben Gazzara, Toshiro Mifune, Richard Roundtree. Yeah, so of course it would have been about the Korean War. And let me see if I can find out any info about it. It was on one of the third Golden Raspberry Awards. So I've got that. Let me just check it out at the IMDb and see who else we've got in it, because I'm sure there would have been other actors of note in there. David Janssen was in it. Loved David Janssen. His scenes were deleted, though. Nobody else really big on there. Rex Reed was in it. His scenes were deleted. Gabriel Fazzetti, who played James Bond's father-in-law on Her Majesty's Secret Service. He's in there playing a Turkish brigadier, of all things. But, yeah, if anybody has a copy of it or can steer us in the direction of that, Richard and myself would both be interested in checking it out. So, yeah, the intro. But the other two, Quintet, Paul Newman didn't do a lot of science fiction, so I might be interested to watch that. And The Witchmaker, if it has attractive 1970s movies, women in it, sorry, I'm there. I'm totally there. So I'll give that one a go. Now, that's it for the voicemails. I did receive a little bit of other feedback. I'm just going through my Facebook. Martin Cook suggested that I do some surrealist films. Now, he says, I don't hear too many podcasts talking about Buñuel, for instance. Other surreal cult favourites of his, The Bed Sitting Room, Richard Lester's film, Three Businessmen, Motorama, and Oh Lucky Man, the Lindsay Anderson film. Oh Lucky Man I liked, partly for the Alan Price soundtrack on it. But, yeah, surrealist films. It's on the list now. It's in the Watchmen notebook. I will have to do some surrealist movies, and I'm sure there are a number of them. In fact, Cabin of Caligari, in a sense, is a surrealist movie. There are some surrealist moments in it in the same way that there were in Shock Corridor. But yeah, good suggestion, Martin. Thank you very much for that one. Just going through the other Twitter, Facebook stream. The thing is, it's hard to bookmark Facebook comments and then refer back to them. If anyone's got a way of doing it, let me know. So I'm going to leave off there and finish up for the podcast. It is now 2:16 in the morning, by the way. I started this around midnight, so that goes to show you it's a slightly unusual thing. Saturday night, Sunday morning at the moment. I was going to do it earlier today, but things like a refrigerated delivery and other things kind of delayed it a bit. So that's about it this time around. Next time, as I said, the career and history of Rod Taylor. Going to enjoy doing that one because there are so many cool films to talk about. There won't be any spare space there. And we then also have Dr. Zom's comments about the cinema of Rod Taylor. Anyway, that's about it. I will mention a couple of things. First one is that the website, paleo-cinema.blogspot.com, is still up and running, and I'm putting the trailers up before the films and things like that. There's also a PayPal link, so if somebody suddenly wins a lottery and wants to give me $15, I'll be very happy. And if not, please still enjoy the podcast. I mean, I've got to pimp things occasionally, but hopefully not too much. The other thing I was going to mention is that there is a bit of a teaser for me doing a little bit of stuff on Australian radio. I've only just got a Facebook message about it yet. It may not come to pass, but there's an interesting possibility there. I'm not going to go beyond that at this stage, but I was quite excited by the prospect. It won't be anything major, but I would very much like to see what develops from that. Won't talk about it unless it comes through, so don't prod me about it. I'll let you guys know once something happens, if it does happen with that. Anyway, that's about it. I'm going to go off and go to bed now after I upload all this and edit it. And in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching. Thank you for everybody for their support. Congrats publicly for the guys over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema for 100 episodes. You guys are class acts, even though the local toilet walls where I live say otherwise. And that's about it this time around. Enjoy your movie viewing, and I'll be back in 3 weeks' time. Take care.